Humanity is in trouble. Some of us are here to help. Together, we will take the next step.
Welcome back to the Next Step Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Sanchez. It's been a while, and I hope you're doing well. We're going to talk about zombies today. That's what the whole show is about, zombies. Growing up, I always loved zombie movies and horror films. I'm no movie buff in any genre, but I've always liked zombie films. You know, it's the suspense and the thrill of it all, you know, and the bit of, more so when I was a kid, you know, the fear associated with zombie films. But I also really love the artwork, the special effects makeup that goes into these movies. Horror movies in general, but zombie movies in particular. I don't know, maybe I just have a strange imagination, but that kind of stuff really just excited me when I was a kid. And I never really had much of an artistic ability, so I never got into special effects makeup, but I probably would have. So, cut to about, I think it was about the end of 2008, I was listening to the C Rum podcast with KMO, and he had on Neil Kramer, somebody you have heard on a previous episode of this show. And KMO and Neil Kramer were talking about zombies. It was episode 134 of the C Rum podcast entitled Zombie Apocalypse Christmas Special. You can check that out at the podcast archives for the C Realm if you go to c-realm.com. Look at the podcast archives for the C Realm, episode 134. So KMO and Neil Kramer are talking about, started off talking about George Romero and his movies, and that were not maybe they weren't the beginning of zombie films, but they sort of brought things to a different level. And since I've always just watched films and never really got into more of maybe what they meant, it was very enlightening to listen to KMO and Neil Kramer talk about these zombie films in a way that related them to social criticism and commentary and maybe even perhaps sort of the subconscious mythology that is emerging out of our culture. And so I took zombies to mean much more than just, you know, a fun horror movie kind of a thing. And so I absorbed some more zombie materials as time went on, and then sometime last year I was talking with KMO, and he was talking about this book called World War Z, which is about the post-zombie apocalypse Earth, and a guy from the United Nations goes around and interviews a bunch of the survivors and gets their story about what happened. And it's really a great book. I actually haven't read the book. I've listened to the audiobook, which is phenomenal. And that was what was first suggested to me by KMO. So the World War Z audiobook just really blew me away because it was less about the zombies and more about human beings. And again, bringing back this idea of like social commentary underneath the zombie mythos, that World War Z really delivers in that way and to a very high quality. So what you're going to hear in this episode is me and KMO just talking a bit, setting up this concept of zombies as being more than just the living dead coming to eat your brains. And I'm going to play a couple of the segments of the audiobook version of World War Z. And I think so much of what is covered in World War Z is relevant to people in general, but the two segments that I selected are most relevant to the Next Step podcast audience. And so I offer this all to you as food for thought and entertainment, and maybe it'll inspire you to go check out some zombie films and do some thinking on this stuff on your own, and definitely check out World War Z, the audiobook version. So anyway, you're going to hear the rest of this. I don't need to babble on anymore. Let's get into it. Here's me and KMO talking about it. I'll see you on the other side, and until then, aim for the head.
Really, it's through your show and you talking to Neil Kramer that I even considered zombies as anything more than just like a sick I don't know, fascination or something like that. So,
well, there certainly is that. I've said repeatedly that all of the fancy talk I have about zombies was created after the fact, that the fascination came first.
Well, you guys took it to a whole new level.
Dawn of the Dead, when I first saw it sometime in the mid-80s, I was just blown away. I mean, it's the fact that it's kind of low budget and there's sort of a documentary feel to it,
mm-hmm.
makes the fact that there's this graphic imagery of, you know, people biting into other people and pulling out their entrails and such just so arresting. And, you know, all the things that I can say about it that tie it to more weighty topics is sort of after the fact hand waving to excuse my own fascination with the image of cannibalism and, you know, close interaction with corpses, which is such a taboo.
Yeah, it's weird, man, and there is that feeling that you get when you watch these zombie films. Like, you think of what would it be like if I were to be in the situation. And one thing I don't know if I heard you mention this on your podcast or seen you talk about it online somewhere, but you've had like recurring end of the world apocalyptic zombie dreams, and that's something I've had quite a bit too. Not so recently, surprisingly, but those are always really, really intense dreams, you know, and they're always just, I mean, just completely to the bone, scary kind of affairs.
Yeah, I think I did talk about that on a podcast somewhere. And yeah, I used to have these cyclical dreams. It would always be, you know, there's a zombie apocalypse, and I can like smell it in the air. I'll be in a dream, mm. and it's just a normal scene, and nothing really strange going on. But there's suddenly a quiet, and I can feel a little tingle in the back of my neck that says, "Uh-oh, the zombie apocalypse has begun. Find shelter." And I always get together with a group of, you know, survivors, and we hole up in some stronghold, and it gets overrun, and I escape with some smaller subset of that group, and we establish a new stronghold, and it gets overrun, and just, you know, rinse and repeat.
Yeah, pretty much. That's how my dreams have been, too. But a lot of times, there will be some other deeper psychological meaning embedded within it, you know, that isn't zombie-related, but, the whole backdrop and the whole theme of this, the dream is zombies, and oh my God, I haven't had one for a while. I get a lot of UFO dreams, but it's been a while since I've had a zombie dream. And actually the last one that I had, I think I got overtaken. I think I had been bitten. So,
you know, I've never been bitten in one of those dreams. That would be interesting.
I didn't actually get bitten, but it was like, you know, the dream gets so bad that you just like switch to another dream or whatever. You leave it.
It was
pretty much like, yeah, all right, I'm fucked on this one, so I'm out.
Reset.
Yeah. But one thing, I guess you could just kind of summarize briefly, just to sort of set the context for the clips here in World War Z, because I noticed immediately World War Z was much more, wasn't so much about zombies as it was about people in society. And
right.
And so the clips I picked just kind of highlight on the one end, you know, sort of one of our biggest flaws and weaknesses in the way we structure and over compartmentalize and you know, form our society in that way, and then on the other end, how, you know, people can come back from that in a certain way. And Cuba's already gone through that with the whole peak oil crisis they had when the Soviet Union collapsed. But before we get all into that, just sort of paraphrase, you know, this other aspect of the zombie myth, you know, that relates to society and culture and not just about eating people.
Say more about what you have in mind.
Well, yeah, I guess there's a lot you can go into. I mean, really, there is a lot. You've mined it quite a bit already and still going with the Z-Realm podcast. But, well, I guess the big thing is that it's sort of like an archetypal image of the madness that people sense underneath the radar in society. Like if some sort of collapse situation did occur, you know, our neighbors are going to be like those zombies. You know, people are going to be hungry and, not so friendly with each other when times are really, really tough.
Yeah. It kind of depends on what you mean by neighbors there.
Well, people who live around you.
Yeah. Our technologically enabled society has allowed us to live with such an unprecedented population density. And so, you know, I just came from New York City where, you know, New Yorkers are pretty nice people, but they also have these sort of ingrained mechanisms in themselves which keep them from interacting on an interpersonal level with very many people. So, you know, eye contact is sort of taboo. You don't make eye contact with people on the subway or on the bus. It's just not done. You know, and to do that, even if you're a smiling, happy, friendly Midwesterner, you know, who wants to just talk to the people around them, the New Yorkers consider that really aggressive, you know, aggressively invading their space and their privacy. And so, you know, here on the farm, one, a zombie apocalypse is not going to spread that quickly because there's not much population density. But two, all the people here know each other. And so you're not going to have the same sort of fear of this mass of people that I don't know, but I realize that if push comes to shove, they don't know me either, and they're going to try to take what's mine, or they're going to try to, you know, they will prioritize their own survival over mine. And because we don't know each other, they are going to default to that. Whereas in a place where you actually know your neighbors and there aren't that many and resources don't seem to be so obviously constrained, then even if there is some sort of threat like a zombie apocalypse, you're not going to get the same behaviors from people. So I think the zombie apocalypse archetype, it assumes or it highlights certain ways that we have changed so that we can operate living more like insects. You know, we live in these huge colonies now, and that's not how primates live. And you know, primates live in these loosely organized bands that once they get over a certain size, they divide and they, you know, they form two bands.
Mm-hmm.
And they might retain some sort of clan affiliation, but, you know, they're two separate bands. Whereas now we're acting more like ants or termites. We can have one band that has 10 million individuals in it. And that is just alien to us. And we have a lot of anxiety over it, even if we're not able to articulate it or really understand what the anxiety comes from. And I think that the zombie apocalypse narrative really taps into that, exploits it. And I think to some extent, you know, after decades of us being sort of pricked by it, we've come to realize what it is inside that this thing is activating. You know, what is the nature of this fascination and this paranoia and this sort of dread, which we... one, you know, see is horrific, but two, can't wait to get more of. You know, I can't wait for The Walking Dead season two.
Yeah,
coming
me too.
Along pretty soon here.
June, right? End of June?
I had heard that at one point, but I would think that if there were already, you know, episodes in the can and were going to be airing as soon as end of June, that we'd be seeing commercials everywhere.
Mm. I don't have TV, so I don't know. I just
you've got the internet. I would.
I download it.
Ads everywhere.
Yeah, probably. I know it's coming up soon, though. I thought.
I hope. You know, there is no knowing with things like these.
Yeah, there's the other show on that channel, Breaking Bad, that I'm pretty sure is coming up soon. I thought they were both coming out at the same time, though.
Ah.
I don't know.
The first two seasons of Breaking Bad, I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's a really good show. I'm looking forward to that. The other side of the society of zombie coin that I kind of think about sometimes is, it's more cynical, but it's the idea that, you know, in this culture, in the society as it is now, pre-collapse, you know, you might say there are some people who are thinking about these problems and these issues that we discuss on my show, on your show, and other places, and highly outnumbered. And completely, you know, sometimes alone. You know, there's many people that are entertaining these ideas about permaculture, living in a town by themselves, and these ideas are not welcomed. And so then it's almost like this idea that the people around us now are, in a sense, sort of in a state of zombie-like menace, because they're just regurgitating this cultural meme, this cultural mindset that's completely different from permaculture, you know? And that's kind of something I think about too, is it's not so much like, oh God, you people are fucking stupid, wake up, you zombies, like the Alex Jones approach. But on, you know, at the same time, it's still kind of like that a little bit. It seems like, you know, like people are great, but they just aren't paying attention. And that's dangerous. It seems to me a lot of people just being distracted constantly, a society full of that just seems really dangerous.
A society is full of anything, as our society can be, you know, in this unprecedented way, I think is dangerous. It occurred to me a few days ago, or a week or so ago, that, you know, if you've got your Dunbar's number informed human civilization, not civilization, but a human band, you know, you've got 140 people, say, living together. You might have one person who has the mentality of the shaman. And that person is normally, in those circumstances, the only one. Or if there's two, then they're different in age, and one is the apprentice of the other.
Mm-hmm.
But now, with 7 billion people, you know, you've got a lot of people with that shaman neurological wiring. And now that person who is traditionally, or, you know, in not ecological, in evolutionary timescales, traditionally alone, you know, the lone person who lives off on the edge of the village, now this is a demographic. And you're getting all these people who, via the internet, are discovering those others, you know, with their sort of outlier neurological wiring. And that's probably never really happened before. You never really had, you know, a Burning Man where everybody who showed up was the shaman from the tribe. And you had a million shamans together in one place. Or I don't know how many people go to Burning Man. It might not be that many, but... And so, I don't know. I don't know that it's necessarily an unqualified positive thing. There could be a shadow side to getting that many, you know, cultural creatives or whatever you want to call them together and communicating and working together. They might have all kinds of unreasonable expectations about transforming society and making it more humane. You know, mm-hmm. And I say that half ironically, as if, you know, how could that be a bad thing? But just, you know, history is replete with unintended consequences and black swans and, you know, who knows? Who knows what catastrophic fallout might come from something which seems like an unqualified good?
Too much of a good thing.
Yeah, or a good thing, you know, applied in a way that just, it never had been before, and not that nature has intentions, but, you know, in the metaphorical way that we use that language, in a way which nature never intended.
Okay, so World War Z, I'm going to be playing some clips, and you're covering this on you're on the Sea Realm podcast, and I've had you on the show, so my audience is familiar with the Sea Realm podcast, but you're also voiced on the Z Realm podcast.
Yes, Z for Zombie, and yeah, we're doing what I think is probably going to be a 5-part series on World War Z.
Nice, that is good to hear, because you're only on 2 right now.
Well, we've recorded the third, and Marty's going to get it put together here in the next couple of days, I think.
Okay, cool, man. Hell yeah. So, the Z Realm, you guys cover, it started, you guys were inspired, obviously, by your love for zombie films and the whole mythos, but with the show Walking Dead, I think, what, right? Was that your initial
trigger?
That was trigger?
The catalyst, yeah.
Okay. But you cover everything zombie, so obviously you're still going even while the show's been off, out of season for a while.
Yeah, we're not really cranking them out right now. I think we're hitting about one a month, but yes, the show continues even in the hiatus for the TV show.
Cool. So then World War Z, you actually suggested, were the final thing to suggest that I read or listen at least to World War Z and actually caused me to do so. I've known about it for, I don't know, a year or so, and I've heard a couple of people say, yeah, it was good. But then you and Marty were driving back from Cincinnati and I talked to you briefly and you're like, dude, we're listening to this. You got to check it out. It's good stuff. Good stuff. So I got it. I had my friend listen to it first because I didn't have a chance and she was really excited to hear it. And she's like, oh my God, it just pisses me off because it's just showing how, you know, messed up people can be. And, you know, she's kind of riled up by some of the parts about it, the social commentary. And I'm like, oh God, I really got to listen to this. And then when I listened to it, I knew what she was talking about for sure. Like it's much more, it's not so much about zombies as you would think.
No, it's about governments and, you know, how they respond to crisis. It is about people and their unworkable expectations about a lot of things. And, you know, to some extent, it's about zombies. Max Brooks had written a zombie survival guide before this.
Mm-hmm.
Which gave no indication whatsoever that he was capable of something as nuanced and just really dense and substantial as World War Z.
Yeah, I've seen the zombie survival guide, so I definitely can agree with that.
All right. I was being very tolerant of this bee that was crawling around my foot, but tolerance has reached its limit.
KMO, don't do it, man.
Get out of here.
Don't do it, man.
I'm going to have to move. It's really, really into me. All right. So where were we? You want me to say something to set up a clip? What are you going to play?
Yeah, I'm going to play the Alan Alda one and then the John Turturro, the Cuba one. I don't know if you cover the Alan Alda thing on your show, and I'd hate to put, like, you know, your listeners who listen to my show through it again. So maybe just kind of mention something about the Cuba affair.
Well, yeah, the Cuba affair was really, in the book, Cuba being an island has a certain defensibility to it. Although in the novel, the zombies are quite capable of surviving, you know, in quotes, staying reanimated corpses underwater indefinitely. And so you've got just hordes of them roaming the ocean floor. But even so, Cuba manages to contain the outbreak and retain its own sovereignty and its own viability as a national government when other governments are just crumbling, particularly the United States. And a lot of people from North America, mostly USanians, as Albert would say, flee to Cuba, and when they get to Cuba, they get put into refugee camps, which are basically concentration camps. And somebody comes up with the brilliant idea that you can work your way out, and then once you get out, you can earn credits that will get your loved ones out as well. And so you get basically a lot of people who were used to thinking of Cuba as being an inconvenience or an enemy or something, see it as a safe haven. They go there and they get treated like, you know, refugees get treated when they try to get into Australia or the United States or some other wealthy place that is surrounded by poor people. And they get ruthlessly exploited. But at the same time, the North Americanos who come in, they also bring with them their certain expectations about being able to make a political situation better and, you know, having certain inalienable rights and things like that. And at the end of that chapter, we learn that all of that led to a very peaceful revolution in Cuba, and that Fidel Castro's last act as the leader of Cuba was to vote himself out of office and make it sound like the whole thing was his idea. So it just goes back to the sort of modus operandi of World War Z, which is intense research on the culture or the region that is being examined in a particular chapter so that it comes across as something that really is informed by the real world and is not just a zombie adventure story that has a global setting rather than a localized setting.
Yeah, it's really amazing how well researched it is, and it's informative in a way because it's that idea of truth in fiction, you know, and sometimes you can find a little bit more truth in a fictional work, you know, make it a bit more real because it doesn't have to be held to the letter. So yeah, I'm going to go ahead and play that clip right now.
Cienfuegos, Cuba. Seriosha Garcia Alvarez suggests I meet him at his office. The view is breathtaking, he promises. You will not be disappointed. On the 69th floor of the Montalbo Savings and Loan Building, the second tallest building in Cuba after Havana's Jose Marti Towers, Señor Alvarez's corner office overlooks both the glittering metropolis and bustling harbor below. It is the magic hour for energy-independent buildings like the Montalbo, that time of the day when its photovoltaic windows capture the setting sun with their almost imperceptible magenta hue. Señor Alvarez was right. I am not disappointed.
Cuba won the zombie war. Maybe that's not the most humble of statements given what happened to so many other countries, but just look at where we were 20 years ago as opposed to where we are now. Before the war, we lived in a state of quasi-isolation, worse than during the height of the Cold War. At least in my father's day, you could count on what amounted to economic welfare from the Soviet Union and their Comecon puppets. Since the fall of the Communist bloc, though, our existence was one of constant deprivation. Ration food, ration fuel. The closest comparison I can make is that of Great Britain during the Blitz. And like that other besieged island, we too lived under the dark cloud of an ever-present enemy. The U.S. blockade, while not as constricting as during the Cold War, nonetheless sought to suffocate our economic lifeblood by punishing any nation that attempted free and open trade. As successful as the U.S. strategy was, its most resounding triumph was allowing Fidel to use our northern oppressor as an excuse to remain in power. You see how hard your life is, he would say. The blockade has done this to you. The Yankees have done this to you. And without me, they would be storming our beaches even now. He was brilliant. Machiavelli's most favorite son. He knew we would never remove him while the enemy was at the gates. And so we endured the hardships and the oppression, the long lines and the hushed voices. This was the Cuba I grew up in, the only Cuba I could ever imagine. That is, until the dead began to rise. Cases were small and immediately contained, mostly Chinese refugees and a few European businessmen. Travel from the United States was still largely prohibited, so we were spared the initial blow of the first wave mass migration. The repressive nature of our fortress society allowed the government to take steps to ensure that the infection was never allowed to spread. All internal travel was suspended, and both the regular army and the territorial militias were mobilized. Because Cuba had such a high percentage of doctors per capita, our leader knew the true nature of the infection weeks after the first outbreak was reported. By the time of the Great Panic, when the world finally woke up to the nightmare breaking down their doors, Cuba had already prepared itself for war. The simple fact of geography spared us the danger of large-scale overland swarms. Our invaders came from the sea, specifically from an armada of boat people. Not only did they bring the contagion, as we have seen throughout the world, there were also those who believed in ruling their new homes as modern-day conquistadors. Look at what happened in Iceland, a pre-war paradise so safe and secure they never found the need to maintain a standing army. What could they do when the American military withdrew? How could they stop the torrent of refugees from Europe and Western Russia? Is it no mystery how that once idyllic Arctic haven became a cauldron of frozen blood? And why, to this day, is it still the most heavily infested white zone on the planet? That could have been us, easily, had it not been for the example set by our brothers in the smaller Windward and Leeward Islands. Those men and women from Agia to Trinidad can proudly take their place as some of the greatest heroes of the war. They first eradicated multiple outbreaks along their archipelago. Then, with barely a moment to catch their collective breaths, repelled not only seaborne zombies, but an endless flood of human invaders, too. They spilled their blood so that we did not have to. They forced our would-be latifundista to reconsider their plans for conquest and realize that if a few civilians armed with nothing but small arms and machetes could defend their homeland so tenaciously, what would they find on the shores of a country armed with everything from main battle tanks to radar-guided anti-ship missiles? Naturally, the inhabitants of the Lesser Antilles were not fighting for the best interest of the Cuban people, but their sacrifices did allow us the luxury of setting our own terms. Any seeking sanctuary would find themselves greeted with a saying so common among Norte Americano parents, "While under my roof, you will obey my rules." Not all of the refugees were Yankees. We had our share from mainland Latin America, from Africa, Western Europe, Spain especially. Many Spaniards and Canadians had visited Cuba either on business or holiday. I had gotten to know a few of them before the war. Nice people, polite, so different from the East Germans of my youth, who used to toss handfuls of candy in the air and laugh while we children scrambled for it like rats. The majority of our boat people, however, originated from the United States. Every day, more would arrive by large ship or private craft, even on homemade rafts that brought an ironic smile to our faces. So many of them, a total of 5 million, equal to almost half of our indigenous population, and along with all the other nationalities, they were placed under the jurisdiction of the government's quarantine resettlement program. I would not go so far as to call the resettlement centers prison camps. They could not compare to the lives suffered by our political dissidents, the writers and teachers. I had a friend who was accused of being a homosexual. His stories from prison cannot compare to even the harshest resettlement center. It was not easy living, however. These people, no matter what their pre-war occupation or status, were initially put to work as field hands, 12 to 14 hours a day growing vegetables in what had once been our state-run sugar plantations. At least the climate was on their side. The temperature was dropping, the skies were darkening, Mother Nature was kind to them. The guards, however, were not. "Be glad you're alive," they shout after each slap or kick. "Keep complaining, and we throw you to the zombies." Every camp had a rumor about the dreaded zombie pits, the hole in which they throw the troublemakers. The DGI, the General Intelligence Directorate, had even planted prisoners in the general population to spread stories about how they personally witnessed men being lowered headfirst into the boiling lake of ghouls. This was all just to keep everyone in line, you see. None of it was actually true. Though, there were stories about the Miami whites. The majority of American Cubanos were welcomed home with open arms. I myself had several relatives living in Daytona who just barely escaped with their lives. The tears of so many reunions in those early frantic days could have filled the Caribbean Sea. But that first wave of post-revolution immigrants, the affluent elite who had flourished under the old regime and who spent the rest of their lives trying to topple everything we worked so hard to build, as far as those aristos were concerned, I am not saying there's any proof that they were thrown to the ghouls by their fat, reactionary, Bacardi Blanca-drinking asses, but if they were, they can suck Batista's balls in hell.
A thin, satisfied smile crosses his lips.
Of course. We couldn't have actually attempted this kind of punishment with your people. Rumors and threats were one thing, but physical action, push your people, any people, too far, and you risk the possibility of a revolt. 5 million Yankees all rising in open revolution. Unthinkable. It already took too many troops to maintain the camps, and that was the initial success of the Yankee invasion of Cuba. We simply didn't have the manpower to guard 5 million detainees and almost 4,000 kilometers of coastline. We couldn't fight a war on two fronts. And so the decision was made to dissolve the centers and allow 10% of the Yankee detainees to work outside the wire on a specialized parole program. These detainees would do the job Cubanos no longer wanted. They laborers, dishwashers, street cleaners. And while their wages would be next to nothing, their labor hours would go to a point system that allowed them to buy the freedom of other detainees. It was an ingenious idea. Some Florida Cubano came up with it, and the camps were drained in 6 months. At first, the government tried to keep track of all of them, but that soon proved impossible. Within a year, they had almost fully integrated the Norte Cubanos, insinuating themselves into every facet of our society. Officially, the camps had been created to contain the spread of infection. But that wasn't the kind spread by the dead. You couldn't see this infection at first, not when we were still under siege. It was still behind closed doors, still spoken in whispers. Over the next several years, what occurred was not so much a revolution as an evolution. An economic reform here, a legalized privately owned newspaper there. People began to think more boldly, talk more boldly, slowly, quietly. The seeds began to take root. I'm sure Fidel would have loved to bring his iron fist crashing down on our fledging freedoms. Perhaps he might have, if world events had not shifted in our favor. It was when the world governments decided to go on the attack that everything changed forever. Suddenly, we became the arsenal of victory. We were the breadbasket, the manufacturing center, the training ground, and the springboard. We became the air hub for both North and South America, the great dry dock for 10,000 ships. We had money, lots of it, money that created an overnight middle class and a thriving capitalist economy that needed the refined skills and practical experience of the Norte Cubanos. We shared a bond I don't think can ever be broken. We helped them reclaim their nation, and they helped us reclaim ours. They showed us the meaning of democracy, freedom, not just in vague, abstract terms, but on a very real, individually human level. Freedom isn't just something you have for the sake of having. You have to want something else first, and then want the freedom to fight for it. That was the lesson we learned from the Norte Cubanos. They all had such grand dreams, and they laid down their lives for the freedom to make those dreams come true. Why else would El Jefe be so damned afraid of them? I am not surprised that Fidel knew the tides of freedom were coming to sweep him out of power. I am surprised at how well he rode the wave.
He laughs, gesturing to a photo on the wall of an aged Castro speaking in the Parque Central.
And you believe the cojones of that son of a bitch to not only embrace the country's new democracy, but to actually take credit for it. Genius. To personally preside over the first free elections of Cuba, where his last official act was to vote himself out of power. That is why his legacy is a statue and not a bloodstain against a wall. Of course, our new Latin superpower is anything but idyllic. We have hundreds of political parties and more special interest groups than sands on our beaches. We have strikes, we have riots, we have protests, it seems, almost every day. You can see why Che ducked right out after the revolution. It's a lot easier to blow up trains than to make them run on time. What is it that Mr. Churchill used to say? Democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others.
Zombies are on the loose, be courageous. They're totally disgusting, their condition is contagious. They'll try to bite your body, but don't let them. The situation's getting worse, we better go get them. Zombie apocalypse, the day has come, the party starts. Look out for raggedy people with rotten body parts. Don't drink water from a contaminated source. It's time to do battle with a reanimated corpse. Prepare yourself physically and mentally steady, yes. They're known for the muddy dress, their face is a bloody mess. Zombie invasion, the problem's international. Don't try to reason with them, zombies are irrational. These are dead people. Imagine how they smell. If you're bitten, then you become a zombie yourself. They don't need raisins or peanuts or chocolate chips. Shoot them in the head. It's the zombie apocalypse.
Zombie to life. Zombie to life. Zombies are coming to catch us tonight. Zombie to life. Zombie to life. Zombies are coming to catch us tonight. Zombie to life. Zombie to life. Zombies are coming to catch us tonight. Zombie to life. Zombie to life.
Why is this happening? People are frantic. The military's overwhelmed, widespread panic. Cities are destroyed and the streets run red. How do we contain this plague of the undead? Weaponize thyself, call on the troops. Zombies have the tendency to mobilize in large groups. There's very little information and no answers. One weird thing is that they're excellent dancers. Watch this. From hell, revitalized remains. The only thing they know how to say is the word brains. That's all they're interested in is your gray matter. Hey, batter, hit them in the head and they may splatter. The zombie tsunami is out of control. Hide in your basement or go on patrol. The world is being pillaged of its beauty and its worth. Brain dead zombies are taking over planet Earth.
Zombie to life, zombie to life. Zombies are coming to catch us tonight. Zombie to life, zombie to life.
One more question. I have two of the characters that are my favorite, that stick out in my mind above all the others. And it's not the two that I'm picking for the show, actually. It's the Paul Redeker, that one.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the other is, I can't remember the guy's name. It's the blind Japanese man.
Right.
Those are my two.
I don't know his name either, but yeah, I certainly love that chapter.
What are your, if you had to pick one or two, what would you say are yours?
I really like Todd Wainio, the Mark Hamill character.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely a good, that's my third, I would say.
Yes. And in terms of the performances of the readers, I really liked Jürgen Prochnow, who plays the West German army officer who is ordered to abandon the civilians that he's protecting and take his troops back to some safe and certainly not critical location. Not critical, at least not in terms of protecting civilians.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really well read. I'm holding the actual dead tree version of the book.
Mm.
And as much as I am happy to pimp the audiobook, I got to throw in a shout out for the dead tree version as well, because there are many chapters that were omitted from the audiobook, and in fact, you know, most of the chapters are one-offs. You meet this character, you hear their story, and it gives you an idea of how the general zombie apocalypse and zombie war unfolded, but you never come back to that character. But there are a few, like Todd Wainio, the soldier who's at the Battle of Yonkers and then who is, you know, present when they have come up with a new methodology for fighting the zombies, which is less high-tech but more effective, and then is also present when they sweep back, you know, east of the Rockies and retake all of the America that the U.S. government had abandoned following the South African model. So we see him again and again. And there's another thread like that, which involves the crew of a Chinese nuclear submarine that fled China. And they recur again. This thread encompasses several chapters. It comes up at various points in the book, and it gives you a better idea of what the zombie war was like on the ocean, because that's a huge part of the book.
Oh, man, really?
In the audio novel.
Oh, wow.
And there's another section about how dogs were used in the zombie war in the United States. And there's a character who just had a great affinity for dogs, and he got spotted and sent to the canine corps. And it talks about all they, you know, how they trained the dogs to do all these different things. And you hear a reference to it in the audiobook. You know, Mark Hamill character talks about how they sent the canines out and were using the canines to bring the zombies in. But he doesn't say anything more about it because we've got a whole chapter about it in the book, which you won't get in the audiobook. The chapter that I mentioned that was read by Jürgen Prochnow, you know, which takes place in Europe, and I think it's the Hamburg garrison is ordered to abandon the civilians they were protecting. He makes reference, the person who threatens him says, "You and more importantly your men will be charged with treason and persecuted with Russian efficiency." And the Jürgen Prochnow character says, "You know, I had heard about what was happening in Russia, the revolts, the decimations." And he doesn't say anything more about that. But there's a whole chapter in the book about how the Russians had been sent far from home. You know, the Russian army had been sent far from home to try to contain the outbreak in former Soviet satellite nations. And when the soldiers figure out what's really happening, they start agitating. They're like, "Screw this, we got to go home and protect our place." And so the Russian military sends down this edict that says, okay, the entire military force is going to be broken down into groups of 10 people. And in that group of 10 people, it is the job of that 10 people to pick one person who will be sacrificed, and then the other 9 have to kill that person.
Oh, my God.
And that is the decimation. And, you know, people these days, they use the word decimate just as a synonym for devastate. But really, decimate means reduce by a tenth. You know, I've heard people say, like, the forests have been decimated. And it's like, wow, I wish that were true. You know, I wish we could only reduce the forests by a tenth. So they haven't been decimated. They have been devastated.
God, there's that play on words again.
Different words. And, you know, the decimations in World War Z are a really powerful sort of terror tactic perpetrated by authority figures on the people below them, because not only does it put the fear of death into the rank and file, but since the rank and file, in order to avoid being killed the first time around, had to kill somebody else, then they have this guilt, which is also a sort of psychological terrorism. It keeps them in line and keeps them doing what they're told.
Wow.
Guilt over their own you know, their own culpability at what has happened. So it's a really powerful novel, and as well done as the audiobook is, it is still worth it to read the actual paper version.
Well, I'll definitely be doing that for sure. I didn't think that much good stuff was left out.
Oh, huge amounts of the novel did not make it to the audiobook.
Well, I'm sold. Anyone listening can send me a copy. All right, KMO, thanks for chatting with us today and talking about zombies.
One of my favorite topics.
Yeah, it's definitely grown on me, and I've been bitten by the zombie bug.
He's been bitten by a zombie.
Yeah. All right, man, take it easy.
You too, Jared. Take care.
All right, we're getting to the end of the show here, and I just want to conclude with a few remarks before I play the last clip from World War Z. Thanks to KMO for coming on the show and fleshing out some of the gory details of the zombie mythology. There's so much to be said about it, so obviously we've only taken a few small bites off the top. You can hear more of KMO discussing the zombie theme on the show The Z as in Z, Z Realm podcast with his co-host Marty Hollingsworth. They originally started by following the series Walking Dead each episode of their show, and when the Walking Dead series is not in season, they cover other zombie films and other things related to the zombie mythos. So it's always an entertaining listen. I'm a big fan of the show. I catch every single episode when it comes out, and I suggest you consider doing the same if you're into the whole zombie thing, and or if you weren't before, but you are now after listening to what we've said here today. So yeah, you can check out the Z-Realm podcast at zrealmpodcast.blogspot.com, where you can read the description of each episode and download them as well. So yeah, I'm a big fan of the show. Do check that out. I wasn't completely satisfied with part of KMO's response to this notion of what were we talking about? The shaman in the group. You know, there are some of us, and I think a lot of you listening to this show would fall into this category. There's some of us that find ourselves thinking outside of the box, the normal cultural box, and we find ourselves very alone. You know, we're looking for newer ways help create the world that our hearts tell us is possible, the better world that our hearts tell us is possible, as Charles Eisenstein talks about. And so those of us who feel this way, the shaman type that KMO termed, you know, we feel very alone. And he talked about how that it you know, possible that maybe if we got many more of these types together, it wouldn't be such a good thing after all, because with so many different visions and ideas about what to do, what needs to be done to change the world, just more chaos might be a result of that. It might be worse off for the lesson. So in response to that, I would say that maybe that's true, but this recording happened before the whole Occupy protest movement began in America. There were other things going on across the world. And I'm not going to say that the Occupy movement has been some huge success, but what it has shown is that there are many of these people out there that are looking for new ways. And instead of the old way of just taking on issues and forming protests and having leaders and things like that, like we saw in the civil rights movement in the mid-20th century, what the Occupy movement is showing is that the new way is to not have any particular leader, but to work together as equals, to be completely equal in our efforts to change the world, and to use consensus process and just open dialogue, open hearts, teaching each other what we know, you know, bringing people up to speed on the issues, and it's in this way that I think bringing more of the shaman type together can be a success. So I don't think the Occupy movement is going to bring us, well, it's not directly going to bring us the better world our hearts tell us is possible, But I think it's showing that when we start to get people together in this modern times, in the context that we're in, knowing what we know, we're starting to do things a little differently now. And so, yes, we all might have our own visions of what needs to be done, but we're learning how to bring all of these visions together, and instead of the result being more chaos and dissonance, it's trending towards more coherence, more openness, and more possibilities for something new to emerge, rather than just conflicts of what already exists. So I think that it's actually worth the shaman types finding each other more, interacting more, influencing each other, influencing the people who aren't like them, finding ways to talk about these out-of-the-box ideas with people who are very firmly in the box. That's the only way the Occupy movement, in my opinion, will have any real traction, is if it, instead of continuing to just simply occupy space, it will bring that energy and those techniques and that perspective home to the local setting, and begin to create space there where people can talk about anything, about the problems facing society and the world, and then what we can do about it, and how to begin forming consensus or near consensus, and changing the dialogue, you know, the public discourse, altering it away from banal apathy and consumerism into, you know, active participation, democratic participation, you know, the kind of things that at least I was raised to believe in, you know, that we the people are the government. You know, we've never been told how to make that happen, and I think the Occupy movement is showing us that there's something new going on here, and it may not be fully formed yet, but there's something really heavy underneath it, underlying the whole new birth process that we seem to be experiencing socially. So I wonder what KMO's remarks would have been had the Occupy movement already been underway at the time of this recording. Now, I'm not saying I completely disagree with KMO, because he made a good point. It's just I just couldn't, you know, really get behind that answer for some reason, because my own sense that the more of us who get together who are thinking along these lines and thinking outside of the box, the better. Because otherwise it's just, you know, business as usual, and that seems to be unsatisfying and even dangerous. So, all right, enough of my rambling. I hope you guys enjoyed the show, and I hope you do check out the Z-Realm podcast, World War Z, both the audiobook and the Dead Tree version. Z-Realm podcast, C-Realm podcast, all things KMO, all things zombie, all things the next step, man. Take it to the next level. Do whatever you got to do, but don't be normal. All right, so I'm going to leave you with this last clip from World War Z, and as usual, aim for the head, baby.
Part 5, Homefront USA, Taos, New Mexico. Arthur Sinclair Jr. is the picture of an old-world patrician, tall, lean, with close-cropped white hair. He speaks into the ether, rarely pausing for questions. During the war, Mr. Sinclair was director of the U.S. government's newly formed DISTRESS, or Department of Strategic Resources.
I don't know who first thought of the acronym DISTRESS, or if they consciously knew how much it sounded like distress, but it certainly could not have been more appropriate. Establishing a defensive line at the Rocky Mountains might have created a theoretical safe zone, but in reality, that zone consisted mainly of rubble and refugees. There was starvation, disease, homelessness in the millions. Industry was in shambles. Transportation and trade had evaporated. And all of this was compounded by the living dead, both assaulting the Rocky line and festering within our safe zone. We had to get our people on their feet again, clothed, fed, housed, back to work. Otherwise, this supposed safe zone was only forestalling the inevitable. That was why distress was created. And as you can imagine, I had a lot of on-the-job training. Those first months, I can't tell you how much information I had to cram into this withered old cortex. The briefings, the inspection tours. When I did sleep, it was with a book under my pillow. Each night a new one, from Henry J. Kaiser to Vodnegoyen Jep. I needed every lesson, every word, every ounce of knowledge and wisdom to help me fuse a fractured landscape into the modern American war machine. If my father had been alive, he probably would have laughed at my frustration. He'd been a staunch New Dealer, working closely with FDR as controller of New York State. He used methods that were almost Marxist in nature, the kind of collectivization that would make Ayn Rand leap from her grave and join the ranks of the living dead. I'd always rejected the wisdom he tried to impart, running as far away as Wall Street to shut it out. Now I was racking my brains to remember it. One thing those New Dealers did better than any generation in American history was find and harvest the right tools and talent.
Tools and talent?
A term my son heard once in a movie. I found it described our Reconstruction efforts rather well. Talent describes the potential workforce, its level of skilled labor, and how that labor can be utilized effectively. To be perfectly candid, our supply of talent was at a critical low. Ours was a post-industrial or service-based economy, so complex and highly specialized that each individual could only function within the confines of its narrow compartmentalized structure. You should have seen some of the careers listed on our first employment census. Everyone was some version of an executive or a representative, an analyst or a consultant, all perfectly suited to the pre-war world, but all totally inadequate for the present crisis. We needed carpenters, masons, machinists, gunsmiths. We had those people, to be sure, but not nearly as many as were necessary. The first labor survey stated clearly that over 65% of the present civilian workforce were classified F6, possessing no valued vocation. We required a massive job retraining program. In short, we needed to get a lot of white collars dirty. It was slow going. Air traffic was non-existent. Roads and rail lines were a shambles. And fuel. Good Lord, you couldn't find a tank of gas between Blaine, Washington and Imperial Beach, California. Add to this the fact that pre-war America not only had a commuter-based infrastructure, but that such a method also allowed for severe levels of economic segregation. You would have entire suburban neighborhoods of upper-middle-class professionals, none of whom had possessed even the basic know-how to replace a cracked window. Those with that knowledge lived in their own blue-collar ghettos, an hour away in pre-war auto traffic, which translated to at least a full day on foot. Make no mistake, bipedal locomotion was how most people traveled in the beginning. Solving this problem, no, challenge, there were no problems, was the refugee camps. There were hundreds of them, some parking lots small, some spreading for miles, scattered across the mountains and coast, all requiring government assistance, all acute drains on rapidly diminishing resources. At the top of my list, before I tackled any other challenge, these camps had to be emptied. Anyone F6 but physically able became unskilled labor, clearing rubble, harvesting crops, digging graves. A lot of graves had to be dug. Anyone A1, those with war-appropriate skills, became part of our CSSP, or Community Self-Sufficiency Program. A mixed group of instructors would be tasked with infusing these sedentary, overeducated, desk-bound cubicle mice with the knowledge necessary to make it on their own. It was an instant success. Within 3 months, you saw a marked drop in requests for government aid. I can't stress how vital this was to victory. It allowed us to transition from a zero-sum survival-based economy into full-blown war production. This was the National Reeducation Act, the organic outgrowth of the CSSP. I'd say it was the largest jobs training program since the Second World War, and easily the most radical in our history.
You've mentioned on occasion the problems faced by the NRA.
I was getting to that. The president gave me the kind of power I needed to meet any physical or logistical challenge. Unfortunately, what neither he nor anyone on Earth could give me was the power to change the way people thought. As I explained, America was a segregated workforce, and in many cases that segregation contained a cultural element. A great many of our instructors were first-generation immigrants. These were the people who knew how to take care of themselves, how to survive on very little and work with what they had. These were the people who tended small gardens in their backyards, who repaired their own homes, who kept their appliances running for as long as mechanically possible. It was crucial that these people teach the rest of us to break from our comfortable, disposable consumer lifestyle, even though their labor had allowed us to maintain that lifestyle in the first place. Yes, there was racism, but there was also classism. You're a high-powered corporate attorney. You've spent most of your life reviewing contracts, brokering deals, talking on the phone. That's what you're good at. That's what's made you rich and what's allowed you to hire a plumber to fix your toilet, which allowed you to keep talking on the phone. The more work you do, the more money you make, the more peons you hire to free you up to make more money. That's the way the world works. But one day it doesn't. No one needs a contract reviewed or a deal brokered. What they do need is toilets fixed. And suddenly that peon is your teacher, maybe even your boss. For some, this was scarier than the living dead. Once on a fact-finding tour through L.A., I sat in the back of a re-education lecture. The trainees had all held lofty positions in the entertainment industry, a mélange of agents, managers, creative executives, whatever the hell that means. I could understand their resistance, their arrogance. Before the war, entertainment had been the most valued export of the United States. Now they were being trained as custodians for a munitions plant in Bakersfield, California. One woman, a casting director, exploded. How dare they degrade her like this? She had an MFA in conceptual theater. She had cast the top three grossing sitcoms in the last five seasons, and she had made more in a week than her instructor could dream of in several lifetimes. She kept addressing that instructor by her first name. Magda, she kept saying. Magda, enough already. Magda, please. At first, I thought this woman was just being rude, degrading the instructor by refusing to use her title. I found out later that Mrs. Magda Antonova used to be this woman's cleaning lady. Yes, it was very hard for some, but a lot of them later admitted that they got more emotional satisfaction from their new jobs than anything closely resembling their old ones. I met one gentleman on a coastal ferry from Portland to Seattle. He had worked in the licensing department for an advertising agency, specifically in charge of procuring the rights to classic rock songs for television commercials. Now he was a chimney sweep, given that most homes in Seattle had lost their central heat, and the winters were now longer and colder. He was seldom idle. "I help keep my neighbors warm," he said proudly. I know it sounds a little too Norman Rockwell, but I hear stories like that all the time. "You see those shoes? I made them. That sweater, that's my sheep's wool. Like the corn, my garden." That was the upshot of a more localized system. It gave people the opportunity to see the fruits of their labor. It gave them a sense of individual pride to know that they were making a clear, concrete contribution to victory. It gave me a wonderful feeling that I was part of that. I needed that feeling. It kept me sane for the other part of my job. So much for talent. Tools are the weapons of war, and the industrial and logistical means by which those weapons are constructed.
He swivels in his chair, motioning to a picture above his desk. I lean closer and see that it's not a picture, but a framed label.
Ingredients: molasses from the United States, anise from Spain, licorice from France, vanilla, bourbon from Madagascar, cinnamon from Sri Lanka, cloves from Indonesia, wintergreen from China, pimento berry oil from Jamaica, balsam oil from Peru. And that's just for a bottle of peacetime root beer. We're not even talking about something like a desktop PC or a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Ask anyone how the Allies won the Second World War. Those with very little knowledge might answer it was our numbers or generalship. Those without any knowledge might point to techno-marvels like radar or the atom bomb.
Sinclair scowls.
Anyone with the most rudimentary understanding of that conflict will give you three real reasons. First, the ability to manufacture more materiel, more bullets, beans, and bandages than the enemy. Second, the natural resources available to manufacture that materiel. And third, the logistical means not only to transport those resources to the factories, but also to transport them out to the front lines. The Allies had the resources, industry, and logistics of an entire planet. The Axis, on the other hand, had to depend on what scant assets they could scrape up within their borders. This time, we were the Axis. The living dead controlled most of the world's landmass, while American war production depended on what could be harvested within the limits of the Western states specifically. Forget raw materials from safe zones overseas. Our merchant fleet was crammed to the decks with refugees, while fuel shortages had dry-docked most of our navy. We had some advantages. California's agricultural base could at least erase the problem of starvation if it could be restructured. The citrus growers didn't go quietly. Neither did the ranchers. The beef barons who controlled so much prime potential farmland were the worst. You ever hear of Don Hill? Ever see the movie Roy Elliott did on him? It was when the infestation hit the San Joaquin Valley. The dead swarming over his fences, attacking his cattle, tearing them apart like African driver ants. And there he was in the middle of it all, shooting and hollering like Gregory Peck in Duel in the Sun. I dealt with him openly and honestly. As with everyone else, I gave him the choice. I reminded him that winter was coming and there were still a lot of very hungry people out there. I warned him that when the hordes of starving refugees showed up to finish what the living dead started, he'd have no government protection whatsoever. Hill was a brave, stubborn bastard, but he wasn't an idiot. He agreed to surrender his land and herd only on the condition that his and everyone else's breeding stock remained untouched. We shook on that. Tender, juicy steaks. Can you think of a better icon of our pre-war artificial standard of living? And yet it was that standard that ended up being our second great advantage. The only way to supplement our resource base was recycling. This was nothing new. The Israelis had started when they sealed their borders, and since then each nation had adopted it to one degree or another. None of their stockpiles, however, could even compare to what we had at our disposal. Think about what life was like in the pre-war America. Even those considered middle class enjoyed or took for granted a level of material comfort unheard of by any other nation at any other time in human history. The clothing, the kitchenware, the electronics, the automobiles, just in the Los Angeles basin alone, outnumbered the pre-war population by 3 to 1. The cars poured in by the millions, every house, every neighborhood. We had an entire industry of over 100,000 employees working 3 shifts, 7 days a week, collecting, cataloging, disassembling, storing and shipping parts and pieces to factories all over the coast. It was a little trouble, like with the cattle ranchers, people not wanting to turn over their Hummers or vintage Italian midlife crisis mobiles. Funny, no gas to run them, but they still hung on anyway. Didn't bother me too much. They were a pleasure to deal with compared to the military establishment. Of all my adversaries, easily the most tenacious were the ones in uniform. I never had any direct control over any of their R&D. They were free to greenlight whatever they wanted. But given that almost all their programs were farmed out to civilian contractors and that those contractors depended on resources controlled by distress, I had de facto control. "You cannot mothball our stealth bombers," they would yell. "Who the blank do you think you are to cancel our production of tanks?" At first I tried to reason with them. "The M1 Abrams has a jet engine. Where are you going to find that kind of fuel? Why do you need stealth aircraft against an enemy that doesn't have radar?" I tried to make them see that given what we had to work with, as opposed to what we were facing, we simply had to get the largest return on our investment, or in their language, the most bang for our buck. They were insufferable, with their all-hours phone calls or just showing up in my office unannounced. I guess I can't really blame them, not after how we all treated them after the last brushfire war, and certainly not after almost having their asses handed to them at Yonkers. They were teetering on the edge of total collapse. A lot of them just needed somewhere to vent.
He grins confidently.
"I started my career trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, so I can yell as hard and long as any professional drill sergeant. After each meeting, I'd expect a call, the one I'd been dreading and hoping for. 'Mr. Sinclair, this is the president. I just want to thank you for the job you've done for us, and we'll no longer be requiring you.' It never came. My guess is no one else wanted the job."
His smile fades.
"I could have gone head-to-head against the military for the duration of the war, but I'm grateful in the end that I didn't have to. When Travis D'Ambrosio became chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he not only invented the resource-to-kill ratio, but developed a comprehensive strategy to employ it. I always listened to him when he told me a certain weapon system was vital. I trusted his opinion in matters like the new infantry BDU or the Stanford infantry rifle. What was so amazing was to see how the culture of RKR began to take hold among the rank and file. You'd hear soldiers talking on the street, in bars, or on the train. Why have X when for the same price you could have 10 Ys, which could kill 100 times as many Zs? Soldiers even began coming up with ideas on their own, inventing more cost-effective tools than we could have envisioned. I think they enjoyed it, improvising, adapting, outthinking the bureaucrats. The Marines surprised me the most. I always bought into the myth of the stupid jarhead, the knuckle-dragging, lock-jawed, testosterone-driven Neanderthal. I never knew that because the Corps always has to procure its assets through the Navy, And because admirals are never going to get too fired up about land warfare, that improvisation has had to be one of their most treasured virtues.
Sinclair points above my head to the opposite wall. On it hangs a heavy steel rod ending in what looks like a fusion of shovel and double-bladed battle axe. Its official designation is the Standard Infantry Entrenchment Tool, although to most, it is known as either the lobotomizer or simply the Lobo.
The Leathernecks came up with that one, using nothing but the steel of recycled cars. We made 23 million during the war.
He smiles with pride.
And they're still making them today.